Okay, so first of all, any questions about the logistics of the class? This should be 373 CSE or AMS 373. It's the algorithms class. Last class I passed out a syllabus, so if you didn't pick one up, either go to the course website or you'll come see me. Actually, I may be out of it now, but okay, if you need me to sign any forms to let you in the class, I will do that after class today. Okay, any questions? If you have the forms. If you don't have the forms, I'll sign you in next class. Any other questions about the course, the logistics, or anything? Okay, anybody? Okay, so today's the first class where we have a problem of the day due. All problems of the day will be due at the beginning of class in that on the table as you get it in there. So if anybody still has their problem of the day, toss it in the box. And we will do that. Any questions? Okay. So what is the problem of the day? I'd like to start off with the problem of the day. And it says, basically, prove the correctness of the following recursive procedure for incrementing natural numbers. Okay? So increment means a given y, it returns y plus 1. And the function, the way I would write that function, if I were writing it from scratch, is say that return y plus 1, and that would be my entire function. But they're using a more complicated algorithm here. And the purpose of the problem is to try to show that that algorithm is correct, and then to analyze something about its efficiency. How would I approach this problem? Okay? Yeah.
Mathematical induction.
Well, mathematical induction is what I would be thinking. Whenever I think of recursive reaction, first of all, how do I prove correctness of something? First thing I would look at, it says, do I believe it? Okay? And this offhand to me looks complicated. Okay? It's not obvious to me that this is true or not. Okay? So writing that as a proof, it's obvious, is wrong. Okay? How else might I start to try to prove it's correct? I'd probably try some examples. If I don't believe it, the first thing I'd probably do is try an example. So what would be an interesting example to convince me it works? Okay, I might try 3. Okay, what would 3 do? Okay, if 3 is equal to 0, no. 3 mod 2 equals 1, yes, that's right. Right, that means an odd number. It's a test for an odd number. For an odd number, return 2 times increment of that. So what's going to happen here? What is the floor of 3 over 2? Does anyone know what the floor of 3 over 2 should be? 1. So this is going to say 2 times increment of 1. Do I believe that that works? Well, increment of 1 is 2. Okay, 2 times 2 is 4. That tells me that if the increment worked, then, you know, if this increment of 1 worked, increment of 3 works. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay. What about, so that's the case for 3. What about 4? Does 4 work? Well, this test fails. Return 4 plus 1, yeah, that one I like, okay? So for even numbers, I'm convinced this function works right, correct? But for odd numbers, I'm not as convinced yet, okay? How would I prove it? Okay, whenever I have a recursive program, I would prove it by induction. So how do I prove it by induction? I take a look at the base case. Well, what is the base case? It says for incrementing natural numbers. What are the natural numbers? Is they start with 0? I can't remember if they start with 0 or 1. Okay, so maybe I prove both cases, okay, because I can't remember that. Okay? If it's 0, it works right, correct? Okay? What about if it's 1? 1 mod 2 equals 1. Return 2 times increment of 1 over 2, increment of 0, increment of 0 returned 1. So 2 times 1 is 2. I claim that the basis cases of 0 and the basis cases of 1, okay, both clearly work. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. And if I knew what the natural numbers were, I wouldn't have to do both cases, but I don't remember such things. Okay. So how would I now prove it? I now work for large ed. What cases do I have to worry about? It seems to me the odd cases are different than the even cases, correct? So I would probably say, what if n is equal to 2k, and n is equal to 2k plus 1? Okay? If n is equal to 2k, then this fails. Then this returns 2k plus 1. And that's right. So we know for the even case. For the odd case, what do we know? Okay? The odd case tells us that it's returning 2 times the increment of the floor of 2k plus 1 divided by 2. What is the floor of 2k plus of this? Okay, that I would get k. Why is that? Well, if I separate it out, this is the floor of 2k over 2, or k, plus 1/2. If k is an integer, the floor, if k was equal to 2.5, then I'd be in trouble, right? Then somehow it's going to trigger something different. But we know that k is an integer here, because we're only given this as with, you know, natural numbers, integers. Okay? So if I notice, this procedure won't work right if I give you increment 3.5. Correct? This is an algorithm that would be wrong to increment floating point numbers or fractions. Okay? But because it's an integer, what is the floor of the integer plus 1/2? Well, that's basically just going to be the floor of, that's just going to work out to be k. So this is going to mean 2 times inc sub k. Well, what is inc of k? That's going to be k plus 1. 2 times k plus 1 is 2k plus 2. That is 1 more than 2k plus 1. Therefore, it has incremented it. Okay? And so for both cases, it satisfies the invariant. Any questions about it? Yeah? How do I know that? That is my inductive assumption. Okay, so that's exactly, okay, so that's a good point. Again, it's good to ask questions, and that's an example of a slippery, maybe slippery thing I skipped over. If we're doing this by induction, what is the inductive idea? We prove it for small cases. We proved it for 1. We proved it for 2. Now for 0, we proved it for 1. We now assume it works for everything less than or equal to n. Less than, say, we prove it's true up to less than n. Now we're going to prove it for n. Proving it for n in this case was easy. For this case, it was easy so long as we knew that inc of n over 2 worked. Okay, and we know that that worked. Why? Because we assumed it worked. Okay? And so if it worked for 1 and 2, we showed that it worked for 0 and 1, we showed that it worked for 2. So it worked for 2 means it works for 3, 4, ... Okay? That is the inductive proof. Any questions about that? Okay? Questions like, do it again is a question. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So, yes? Right, so how did I do for the odd numbers? Let me write it more neatly. I know my handwriting is bad. What I really am going to be saying is that the critical issue for the odd numbers is, the acid test is the odd numbers is this. I'm returning 2 times inc of n. Right? That's what I'm returning, right? Now, floor of n. Over 2. That's what I'm returning, right? What is floor of n? Well, if n is equal to 2k plus 1, I'm now doing the substitution. Inc. Floor. 2n plus 1. 2k plus 1, excuse me. Divided by 2. What did this work out to? Well, this I showed was the same as inc. The floor of 2k plus 1 is k. K, by definition, is smaller than n. Why do I know k has to be smaller than n? Because n is twice k, basically. Twice k plus, 1, or plus or minus 1. Okay? So I know that inc of k is going to be equal to what? If it works correctly, what is ink of K? K plus 1. Now that's what I'm returning is 2K plus 1. Is 2K plus 2 times K plus 1, is that what you get by incrementing 2K plus 1? Yes. Okay, so that's where my QED comes. Okay, any questions? Okay, correctness proofs of recursive algorithms almost always come from induction. Correctness proofs from lots of other algorithms come from induction. Induction is your friend, okay? It's a good way to prove things, okay? And it sometimes gets slippery when you're proving, you know, but for recursive algorithms, it usually is fairly straightforward, okay? Yes?
You probably covered this when you're doing induction. I'm still not getting it. When you do ink of K, because you get K from the simple quadratic, that's
right.
Recursive. How do you know K is going to suffice and go for the even case.
Well, okay, so basically what I'm going to do is prove, my proof is going to be, so I prove for the case of n equals 0 and n equals 1, I prove separately. That's one line of argument that I did by plugging it in. I then assumed for k, for, you know, basically up through to n minus 1. And now I'm going to prove it for n. And my proof of n is going to be that there's two possible cases. Case 1 is if n is even. Case 2 is if n is odd. Is there any other possibility for n?
No.
So if I can prove that it works for the even numbers, and I prove it works for the odd numbers, I've proved it works for all the numbers, right? How did I prove it worked for the even numbers? Well, that one was easy, okay? That was because it says it works for the, you know, it does exactly what it says. It adds 1 to it. So that is basically the proof for the even numbers. This is the proof that it works for an odd number, okay? So this logic that I'm doing here is inserting, proving that if you give it an odd number, and it is true for all n smaller than, you know, for all numbers smaller than n, all integers smaller than n, then it is going to be true for that, give you the right answer for that odd number.
So your proof for the odd number that simply has to reduce down to an even number, which you know works?
I'm not really reducing it to an odd number. I'm reducing it to a smaller number. Okay, you're right. There's no guarantee that the floor of y over 2 is an even number or an odd number, right? So I'm not reducing it to an even number. I'm not reducing it to an odd number. I'm reducing it to increment of a smaller number. How do I know that y over 2 is smaller than y? Well, for any number larger than 1 or, than 1 or 2, you divide it by it. You know, you get something smaller. So really what I'm using for my induction is that when you ask what is ink of the floor of n over 2, because I know that it is true for all integers less than n, I know that the floor of n over 2 is less than n, and therefore I know that ink of that number is going to give me the right answer. That is how I know that. Okay? Is that believable? Not believable? Any other questions? Okay? Question?
You said the increment, y over 2 is not guaranteed that y is all over
2. Okay?
It's not guaranteed that y is even more.
Right.
But then when you get into the big statement, y more 2, that's guaranteed.
Okay, so what we're saying here is the following. We agree that over here, when I call this thing, let's say I want to execute this algorithm, I give it to you a value of y. If y was odd, was even, it went through this and just returned. If it was odd, it went and called increment recursively. How many times might it call itself recursively? Is it going to always stop after the next recursive call? Not necessarily. If the floor of y over 2 was even, then it would have stopped. But if the floor of y over 2 was odd, it would go through and make another recursive call, right? And keep getting more and, you know, recursing deeper and deeper and deeper. So I don't know how many, you know, offhand, it might make lots of recursive calls on one integer. So the proof of correctness of this algorithm, my inductive proof here, is not assuming that the next case I go to, it will stop. But it's assuming that since I know that the whole increment function is correct for any integer smaller than n, the moment I call inc of something smaller than n, at this point I can stop and say I know what it's going to give me. I don't know how it's going to go through the juggling of it, but I know it's going to give me the right answer, because I assume it will give me the right answer. Okay? Does that help you out, or are you still confused? Any questions? Any questions? Okay? Yes?
It's not making too strong, but it's just, you know, like, when you're giving us something to prove, like, an algorithm to work, yeah. Is this the only way, like, you use math
method? Is this the only way to prove an algorithm works correctly? The answer is no, okay? I mean, there's lots of different techniques for proving correctness, okay?
So what you have
on
the board is just one way to prove it.
Okay, what I have on the board is just one way to prove this thing is correct. Okay? But it is. When I am confronted with an algorithm and someone says, prove this is correct, okay, if it is recursion, I always instantly, I think induction. Okay? How are we going to prove quicksort is correct? Quicksort is recursion. It is inductive. Okay? Any recursive algorithm, almost certainly the easiest correctness proof is induction. Because induction and recursion are somehow the same thing. Okay? Other techniques to prove algorithms correct, I mean, in 113 you probably saw proof by contradiction. Right? How many people have seen proof by contradiction? How many people never did? Okay? Well, proof by contradiction is a perfectly fine proof technique. Sort of say, how do I prove that this algorithm is not right, is correct? Well, suppose it wasn't. If it wasn't, then there had to be some integer that gave me the wrong answer, right? Suppose this is the integer that gives me the wrong answer, the smallest one. I go and do some jiggling, and suddenly I come up with a smaller number that has to be incorrect. That contradicted my assumption. Therefore, my contradiction proof is wrong. Therefore, the algorithm was correct. So proof by contradiction can work, okay? A certain ad hoc reasoning can work. But for inductive proof, for recursive algorithms, induction is the way to go, usually, okay? I can't imagine a case where it's not, but, you know, it's just a technique, okay? Any questions? Okay? Yes?
In that last case over there, we have to increment our floor of 2 people coming over 2.
Yes.
How do you know that K will be...
At this point?
Yeah.
At this point, I don't know whether K is odd or even. My proof does not here depend upon whether K is odd or even. Look over here. How do I know that N is odd here? I say N equals 2K plus 1.
It has to be odd, but the floor of that.
So you're right in saying N is odd. Is K necessarily odd? No.
I know it's not necessarily odd.
But... Okay, why do I know that it works then?
How do you know that it's K plus 1 when that's set?
Well, because I know that, what is inc? Inc is a function that by definition increments numbers, if it's correct. This function, if it's correct, increments numbers, right? So what is the increment of 5? What is the increment of 7? Okay, so what is the increment of K?
K plus 1.
Okay. So if I know that the increment function of k is correct, the answer to inc of k is going to be k plus 1, right?
You can assume that it's correct.
But why can I assume it's correct? Okay? Because inductively I have proven it, I have assumed it is true for everything less than n. And what do I know? K is about half of n, isn't it? Right? Isn't that true? If n was equal to 2k plus 1, what is k about n over 2? Is n over 2 less than n? Okay, it is. So what is inc of k? K plus 1. That is where I'm using my inductive assumption. Okay? Any questions? I am glad to hear this level of interaction here. This makes me happy. The people aren't sitting on their hands. They're giving me trouble. But that's what I kind of want to see. Any questions? Okay? So, again, you had 113. You presumably had 213 or something. Well, you had 113, certainly. You've seen induction. This is one reason why you saw it. Okay? Any questions? Okay, but the second question is a little different. Okay? It says, analyze this algorithm. How many right shifts does it use? I.e., how many times is line 2 executed in the worst case? First of all, what does this right shift business mean? Okay? Why does the word right shift appear anywhere here? Okay? Any ideas? What do we mean by right shift? Yeah. Right, because what I'm doing is I'm dividing it by 2. Okay? What is the observation? Suppose, let's say, I wrote the number binary, in the number 5 in binary. What is the number 5 in binary? That is it. Okay? What if I did a right shift of it? What do I get after doing a right shift? I hack off the last number. I've got this. What is this number? Actually, this was not 5 to begin with. Excuse me. That's the problem to begin with. This was 5, right? If I did a right shift, what did I get? This. What is the right shift of it? It's not 4. 2. Okay? So I start out with 5. Right shifting it, I think, is giving me the dividing it by 2 and taking the floor of it. Correct? So in fact, this operation here, okay, is just a number of, you know, basically right, this floor of n over 2 is really a right shift, okay? And it wants to know, for a given integer n, how many right shifts might it use, okay? What would be an example of a number that used a lot of, that it would be put through this procedure? What number uses a lot of shifts? Okay, or those will have to be divided by 2 a lot in order to satisfy this algorithm. Yeah? What? 63. Why 63? What is 63? It's odd. Okay, you're saying it's... Well, there are a couple things. 63. First of all, it's not a prime number, not where I come from. Okay? But what else? What is interesting about it? Yes? 2 to a power minus 1. What happens if I pump this number through here? What's going to happen with it? What is 63 written in binary notation? 1111111111, right? Or with a certain number of 1s, which is smaller than that. But it's not important. But what is going to happen when I do this thing? Okay? It's going to say, if it is, when I divide it by 2, I'm going to stop the moment I get an even number. What happens when I divide it by 2 and take the floor? I do a right shift. What's going to happen to this number? I'm just going to take off the first 1. Was this number odd? Is this number going to be odd? So is it going to keep going? Basically, in the binary notation, this procedure is going to stop the moment I hit a 0, right? And in this case, there's no 0 until I have gone through all the bits of the number, right? So the hardest number to increment in this way is going to be a number of the form 2 to the k minus 1. Does everybody kind of agree with that? Okay. Why? Because any other binary number, I mean, the numbers that are formed 2 to the k minus 1, 2 to the n is going to look something like this, subtracting a 1 from it. Pops everything else down to 1, right? So it is indeed these numbers that are the hard ones to increment by this, right? How many rounds will it take for 2 to the k minus 1 till I finish it according to this algorithm? Yeah? You want to say it's the ceiling of log base 2 over 63 is now a special number. Let's think about it now. You say it has something to do with logs, okay? If my number n was 2 to the k minus 1, how many times will it be till I do this as a function of what I have on the board, okay? How many times will it be as a function of k, yeah? I see people counting. Yeah? You say k minus 1, let's try it, okay? I mean, for 2, let's say k, 2 to the k minus 1. If k was equal to 1, what's 2 to the k minus 1? 1, 3, 7, 15, 31. In binary, this is 1. How many shifts do I have to go through till I hit it? 1. Okay, it depends on how I count it, but I think it's 1. In binary, this was 1, 1. How many iterations do I need? 2. This 1, 1, 1, 1, 3. It takes k steps until this thing gets down to 1. I'm not ready to argue if it's k plus 1 or k minus 1 or k. You know, it's basically k. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay? So if you give me a number of the form, 2 to the k plus minus 1, it takes me about k steps, and that's the worst of all possible numbers of size n, right? Okay, so we sort of got a handle on this. Any questions? I have one question. She was mumbling something about logs, okay? Where does the log business come in? Why was she talking about logs? Does anybody know? Yeah?
Well, the numbers that we're going to be looking at are not going to come in the form of 2 to the k minus 1. So in order to get what k is, you have to take the natural log base 2, whatever number you're talking about, to get the k.
Okay, suppose I give you an integer of size n. How many, I represent the number n in binary. How many bits do I need to represent it in binary? Okay? How many? Basically log n bits, right? Suppose I want to represent, what's a good number? Actually, my 42nd birthday will be on Thursday. Okay? So what is 42 in binary? What is 42 in binary? Okay? Beats me. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. 32, 8, 2. According to this, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bits. Sure enough, what is the ceiling of 42? Take the log of it. The ceiling is 64. The log of that will be, sort of 6. So the number of bits I need to represent the number in binary is the log base 2 of that number. Again, plus or minus 1. Okay? So really what she's saying here is that the worst number case number of shifts will be basically log n, where n is the number. Okay? It might be less if it was an even number, I'd do none of them. But on the oddest number I could get, I would still get away with log n of them. Okay? Any questions? Okay, we'll talk more about logarithms, but get used to them. We're going to be dealing with logarithms in here. Any questions? Okay? So how would I approach this one? Basically, I'd try some examples, I'd see what the hard cases were, and then try to reason from that and get some intuition. And once I saw that it's the first zero I see in binary, then I understand this problem completely. Any questions? Any questions about the problem of the day? Okay. Very good. Okay. At this point, I'm going to reclaim my problems of the day so that nobody else turns anything in. If you didn't turn in this problem of the day, turn in the one. So you keep turning in next time. But I don't want people to work on them during class. Any questions? Okay, good. Okay, so now let's get into the lecture material. Any other questions about this problem before we move on? Okay, good. So, last class we started talking about I was mumbling something about this sort of RAM model of computation, which basically said that when we wanted to analyze the efficiency of algorithms, we're going to be basically counting how many steps does the algorithm do. And we're not going to care about, whether a multiplication is faster than an addition. We're not going to count how many steps does our algorithm do. And that is going to be our measure of the complexity of the algorithm. And so what we can think of is the following. Suppose, let's say, I gave you an algorithm problem. I could build the following kind of a graph. Suppose, let's say, let's think, what is a good algorithm problem? Sorting is a good algorithm problem, right? You all know about the sorting problem. We talked about that at the beginning of class. We mentioned that. That says, if I give you n keys, okay, rearrange them so that they're in increasing order. And you all know a bunch of algorithms for sorting. Suppose for a particular sorting algorithm, I took a look at all permutations of three. How many different arrangements of three keys are there? 3 factorial, how much is that? 6, right? I could look at all arrangements of 4 keys. How many arrangements of 4 keys are there? 24. For any given sorting algorithm, that means that there's 6 possible inputs of 3 things, 24 possible inputs of 4 things. If I took any one of those inputs, meaning a permuted data, and I fed it through your sorting algorithm, on that one particular example, it will take a certain number of steps. Right? You give me an algorithm. I give you an input problem, an instance, okay? By executing that algorithm on that instance and counting how many steps we do at each point, we're going to get a total number of steps that were involved in executing that algorithm. Does everybody agree with that? There's nothing very interesting there. Claim is that for any input on any particular algorithm, on any legal input, it will take a certain number of steps, okay? What we're going to be interested in are 3 different notions of the complexity of the algorithm. The worst case complexity of the algorithm would be if I took the hardest of all the instances. If we look at it here, for n equals 3, I've got 6 dots. Those are the 6 instances. Here I've got 24 dots. You just can't see them all. Okay? The worst case complexity is the function that is defined by a given algorithm, where if I count the number of steps that that algorithm takes, I take the largest number of steps, f of n is going to be the largest number of steps on any instance of size n. Okay? That's what I mean by the worst case complexity of it. Okay? And I want to claim that this is a very well-defined function. As perfectly well defined as, you know, the function f of n equals n, or f of n equals n squared, or any other function. If you give me an algorithm, we consider all possible inputs. Okay? Each one's going to take a certain number of steps. We take the largest of those and define the point as going through that. We get a curve that is the worst case complexity. Okay? The worst case complexity of an algorithm is the function that tells me the number of steps, okay, as a function of n, of the worst possible case for that algorithm on an input of size n. Any questions about that? Okay? The best case complexity is as a function of n over all the possible instances of size n. What was the smallest number of test cases, such as, the smallest number of steps you might have used to solve a test case of this? Okay, that's the best case. So let's say that we were in the business of, you wanted to demonstrate to me your algorithm was good. You're trying to give me a demo to impress me. Ideally, you would want to give me this, run it on the simplest possible case, right? So your program ran very fast, right? The best case complexity is the fastest you could possibly fool me your algorithm worked well on by giving it the easiest possible case. The worst case complexity is the, you know, how well your algorithm performs on the hardest possible input, okay, over all inputs of that size. Any questions? And likewise, we can also define another function called the average case complexity, which averaged, took all these points and said, look, I have 24 possible permutations, I count the number of steps for each one, average that. That would be somehow how the algorithm does an average. The important point here is, for every algorithm, there is somehow, ideally, a worst case, average case, and best case complexity function. Okay? And our job as algorithm analysts is to try to learn as much as we can about all three of these functions. And in particular, what we're really going to be concerned about, most of all, is trying to determine as best we can about the worst case behavior of a program. Any questions? Okay, yes.
So when you actually talk about average case complexity, is that the only way you find out, like, just adding up the worst case and the best case and the average?
Well, adding up the worst case and the best case is certainly does not give you the average.
Because for some algorithms, they might work really bad for some inputs, and really bad for some really more inputs.
Right, so certainly taking the best case complexity and the average case complexity and averaging them tells you nothing about the average case behavior, okay? It could be there's one instance that you can solve without looking, okay? Let's say I only know how to count, there could be one case that's extremely easy, but almost every other case is extremely hard, okay? So it requires the number of steps grows very fast as a function of n. Averaging easy, the easy and the hard does not give me the average case. Okay? So average case is something different. Okay? We're really not going to talk about the average case very much in here, because the average case is very difficult to calculate. Okay? The main thing we're going to be interested in is analyzing the worst case complexity. Okay? And the reason is because the worst case is something that's going to be relatively easy to get a handle on and gives us a pretty good idea of how the algorithm does. Okay? Any questions? Any questions about what we mean by the worst case complexity? The worst case complexity of the algorithm is a function defined by the smallest number of... The worst case, okay, is up here. Defined by the maximum number of steps taken on any instance of size n. Any questions? Okay? So it should be clear that for any algorithm, it has a worst-case complexity of it. Okay? In terms of number of steps that it takes. Any questions? Okay? And so this function is a well-defined function. I keep saying this. I want to make sure people sort of understand. This worst-case complexity of a given algorithm is a function that is defined like any other function. Okay? And we just want to analyze that function to get some idea of what it is. That's what algorithm analysis is. Any questions? Okay. Now, the trouble is, we're going to be interested in the worst case analysis of an algorithm, the worst case time complexity of the algorithm. In general, this is what the worst case algorithm time, if you look at plot the worst case time complexity of a particular algorithm as a function of n, you would really get something that looks sort of like this. Slightly different weird things are going to happen as you go from n to n plus 1. Okay? How can I prove that? Well, take a look at this particular problem here. Remember, we saw that n equals, that for a number of size, the number where it's 2 to the n minus 1, it took a lot of steps. Notice that the number 2 to the n would have taken no steps. So if we plotted the actual time complexity of our increment function here, I claim the following is what it would look like. If we plotted the time complexity of our increment function, here is n, here's the time it actually took. For even n, it was going to take zero steps, right? For odd numbers, it's going to grow, you know, it's going to depend upon the particular number, but it's probably going to wiggle up and down a little bit. I'm going to claim that if you plotted the number of steps it took as a function of n, you're going to see a certain amount of up and down motion. Does everybody sort of agree with that? It is not the smooth function, okay? It's got some wiggles and jiggles. And trying to analyze exactly what those wiggles and jiggles are is complicated, okay? We're going to be, in general, interested in trying to talk about smooth upper and lower bounds for a function, because it is easier to think about smooth bounds rather than complicated functions, okay? Any questions about that, okay? If I saw that my stock price, if you take a look at a stock, you know, it's going up and down each day, okay? I don't want to know how much it goes up and down each day. The interesting thing is, well, look, it seems to be growing logarithmically with time. Okay, it seems to be growing exponentially with time, okay, if it's doing well. Or under our current administration, okay, it's decreasing exponentially as a function of time. Okay? So we want to sort of try to come up with a way to come up with upper and lower bounds of this complicated function. So we can talk about that. That is the reason why we're going to be talking about the big O notation. Okay? I want everyone to understand that this... Two reasons why people get confused about dealing with the big O notation. One is they don't like to think about math at all and functions, okay? The other is that they don't realize that what we're trying to do is the reason why we're going to be talking about it. The time complexity of an algorithm, the exact worst case time complexity, is a complicated function. We can't analyze it exactly. All we can do is prove upper and lower bounds to it. And we want to come up with, we need a language for talking about these upper and lower bounds. And that is the big O notation. Any questions? How many people have seen the big O notation somewhere? How many people have never seen the big O notation? Okay, a few people. Okay? Let's start to talk about this a little bit. Okay, so what do we mean by the big O notation? Questions? Okay? So what is the big O notation? Okay? The big O notation is a way to talk about upper and lower bounds. By itself, the big O notation has nothing to do with algorithms. Okay? So when I say that something is big O of something, okay, or theta of something, or omega of something, I'm not necessarily talking about algorithms. I could be talking about stock prices. I could be talking about the amount of memory you need to remember a song. Okay? I'm talking about some function. Big O and omega and theta are ways to talk about upper and lower bounds on that function. Okay? So let's see what the notation is, okay, for talking about functions. When I say that g of n is O of big of n, of f of n, big O of f of n, what that means is that c times f of n is an upper bound on g of n. Okay? So let's just think what that means exactly. Okay, let's draw some pictures here. Okay? It's easier probably to deal with the pictures. Suppose I've got this situation here, where I've got some function, here is f of n, okay? Suppose I've got some function here, g of n. G of n is an upper bound on f of n. Does everybody agree with that? What does upper bound mean? It means that it's bigger than that. Right? So when we say that g of n is equal to O of f of n, what does this mean? Okay, again, it's one thing is we're talking about upper bounds. Okay? It means that that if we take a look at this to be an example here, it means that C times F of n is an upper bound on G of n. Okay? Because I'm going to make maybe it's a little bit backwards here. But somehow C is going to be some constant, let's say 2. Okay? Suppose that F of n is complicated. Okay? But it's always less than 2 times G of n. Okay. Actually, let me just throw a picture. I'm getting a little bit confused about the order here. Okay, but it's easier to see with the picture. Let me just try to show this. So what do we know here? Here is our function f of n. Okay? We know that f of n is O of g of n. If there is some positive constant that multiplying that constant times g of n gives us an upper bound on the function. Okay? We know that we have a lower bound if multiplying it by a constant is always below it. Okay? This is not working out quite right now. And I think there's still some confusion. But the important thing is that we're getting this. First of all, let's think about this as names. Okay? The important thing is that when we say g of n is O of f of n, it means that we're talking about upper bounds. Big O's are dealing with upper bounds. Omegas are dealing with lower bounds. Okay? And thetas are dealing with tight bounds. Okay? So a theta relation means that there is a very, very tight relationship between these two functions. Yes? That basically means that it follows a shape. So let me just try to... okay, let me make this a little clearer. Let's look at an examples now. Okay? This is probably an easier way to think about it, is to look at the examples. Okay? I say that this function is equal to... This is 3n squared minus 100n plus 6. I say that that is order of big O of f of n, because there is some number, some constant, that I can multiply this by such that this is bigger than that. Okay? I want the thing in the big O, big O means upper bound. Okay? And is it true that n squared, is n squared bigger than 3n squared minus that? Well, not by, normally n squared is not bigger than 3 times n squared, right? But is there some constant that multiplied by n squared, this function becomes bigger than this? What is such a constant? 5 is a good one. 20 is an equally good one. Okay, 20n squared is bigger than this. Okay? So that proves that this is equal to big O of that. Any questions? Okay? Now this is sort of a weird thing to think about what equal means. Okay? Sometimes it's better to think of equal as meaning being in the set of functions. Okay? It's not an, okay, it's sort of a strange notion of equality. We say that this thing is in the set of functions that is upper bounded by n squared, because it is, there is some constant c such that c times n squared is bigger than it. Okay? And basically for this particular example, any constant larger than 3 would do the job. Does everybody see that? Is it true that there is some constant times n squared cubed such that that constant times n cubed is always bigger than 3n squared minus something. Is that true? What is a good constant for that? Someone want to suggest a constant? What constant can I multiply by n cubed such that this is always going to be true? 1 is probably a good number. Okay, although actually, is it really true for 1? But what about if n is equal to 1? Okay, well, okay, the answer is 1 will do. Okay, anything larger than 0 will eventually do for large enough n. Okay, so think what it means. Do we believe that n cubed is a bigger function than n squared? Yes. What does that mean? That means that there is some constant times n squared that for large enough values of n, c times n cubed is larger than this. Okay? And certainly c equals 1 will work probably from the beginning. C equals 0.001 would also work for large enough n. Okay? Suppose I set c equals 0.01. For what value of n will this start to be smaller than 0.1 n cubed? Someone make a guess? Where is the sort of n? Suppose I want to now compare 3n squared and 0.01 n cubed. Which function grows faster, 3n squared or 0.01 n cubed? Okay, 0.01 n cubed. Do you have a choice of getting this much salary as a function of time or this much salary as a function of time? If you're going to live long enough, you would prefer this one, right? How many, what value of n do you have do you reach a break-even point in? Yeah? Around 100, right? Because this is going to be n times n squared. At around 100, 100 times 0.01 is 1-ish. So for large enough n, this is always going to beat this. Does everyone agree with that? So basically, we know that this is equal to big O of this because there is some constant times this. That for large enough integers, this is always going to beat that. Okay? Any questions? Is there any constant times n such that c times n is always going to beat 3n squared? Okay? Can someone give me a constant where that will work? What about a million? A million's a big constant. Okay? Will n squared always be less than, is n squared always going to be less than or equal to a million n? No, where's the break-even point? Well, at about a million. Okay, so now originally, 3n squared is going to be much less than a million times n, right? But as n gets larger and larger and larger, around the time we hit a million, or a million over 3, okay, this is now going to be equal to that. A million n is going to roughly equal 3n squared. And then for larger n, this is going to leave it in the dust, right? So a million times n is not an upper bound of this. Does everybody sort of agree with that? What about 10 million? Is that an upper bound? What about a billion billion? There is no integer you can do, no constant c you can put here, such that this side will always beat that. Infinity is a very large place and a large number. The moment you put a constant here, it's going to eventually lose for large enough values of n. Well, but that's what the lower order means, is the fact that there is no constant here, such that this times this always beats that. That is why this is not equal to big O of n. Okay, does everybody sort of see that? This is the definition here. This is important to understand. Big O is talking about an upper bound. When I say f of n equals big O of g of n, I want to say, is g of n an upper bound of the function? It is an upper bound if there is a constant, such that a constant times this is bigger than that for all large enough n. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So let's look back at the technical definition again, just to make sure we believe this. Here's the big O of this. We say f of n is big O of g of n. If there is a constant C, constants N0 and C, such that C times G of N is always bigger than F of N for any N integer greater than N0. Okay? That's what this means. Okay? That's what the big definition of big O is. Okay? Any questions? So if you want to prove is a function here. If you want to ask me, is f of n, let's say is, you know, n to the 1/2, is this big O of n? Okay? How would we prove this? Okay? Is this true or not? Okay, I don't know if it's true or not. Okay, the only way I can tell is it's true. Is it true that n to the 1/2, that there is some constant times n, such that for an n for n greater than n zero, this is true? Can you give me an n, a c, and an n zero, such that this works? What would be a good c? So what do you give me a signal? If I say c equals 1, if I set c equals 1, is it true that n times, that n is greater than square root of n? What would be an integer, what is the value of n0 for which that's true? Okay, I think that for n0 equals 1, that it's true, right? Is it true that for all larger integers? How do I know that? Can someone prove this to me, that for all larger integers than 1, n is larger than the square root of n? This may seem like it's obvious to somebody. Can someone give me a rigorous proof that this is obvious, that this is true? I might prove it like this. I might say that n is equal to square root of n times square root of n. Does everybody agree with that? So therefore, I now say, is it true that n to the 1/2 is less than or equal to n to the 1/2 times n to the 1/2? Now, if I cancel this, is it clear that n to the 1/2 is bigger than 1? Well, this is going to increase as a function of n, and this is going to stay where it is, right? So certainly, for all integers large n, 1 or larger, this is going to be true. Okay? Any questions? Big O of n means upper bound. What are the other two functions? Omega of n stands for lower bound. Okay? So omega, which is the horseshoe thing, okay, that says that there is, f of n is well, again, the one thing to read this is lower bound. Again, I get confused at this, confused about what the relative values of f of n and g of n are here. But the key point here is, we'll say, that we know that this is a lower bound if this is a lower bound of this, if this is bigger than that, right? That's what it means to be a lower bound, right? That the right side is a lower bound of the, is. Here we talked about upper bound, here we talked about lower bound. This is a lower bound if this is bigger than that, right? That's what it means to be a lower bound. So what does it say? If there is some constant times this, such that this is always less than that, then we have the omega relation. Okay? The lower bound relation. Okay? Any questions? Let's look at the example, but the way I think about this, upper bound, lower bound, tight bound. Okay? And then it's sort of which way the constants go works out fairly naturally. So is it true that n squared is a, you know, we had upper bound, is it true that n squared is a lower bound for 3n squared? Well, it is if there is some constant times this, such that this is always less than that, right? A lower bound means that this is smaller than this. Is there any constant that you can multiply n squared by, such that it's always less than this? Okay? What would be a good constant to multiply n squared by to make this side smaller than that? What would be a good constant? Yeah? 2 will work. Okay? Anything less than 3 should work. What constant times this would be cheating? 0. Okay? Because if we're allowed the constant of 0 here to say that this is a lower bound of that, then you could wipe out anything on this side. Does everybody sort of agree with that? So to prove the lower bound relation, what you need to do is to say, is there some positive constant and some far enough far away to go such that this, that constant times this is always less than this? Okay? So certainly it is true that this function, quadratic function, is omega of n squared. Is it omega of n cubed? Is there any constant such that we multiply it by n cubed? That n cubed is all, that constant is always going to be less than 3n squared? Is there anything? What about 0.000001? Is that going to always make this smaller than this? Well, it's going to do very good, well, up until 1 over. N equals 1 over 0.00001. And then this is going to start growing. Okay? And you no longer have the lower bound relation. This side grows faster than that side. You can't hit it with a small enough constant. Okay? To wipe that out. So this is not a lower bound of this. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay. What about this one? Is n a lower bound of 3n squared? Okay. Is there some constant such that that constant times n is less than 3n squared? What is a reasonable constant to prove that for? What constant times n could you use to demonstrate to me that this is less than this? Anything but 0. Certainly, if it was 3, let's say, okay, 3n squared is clearly going to be bigger than 3 times n, right? Maybe we have to also have to deal with these lower order terms, but for large enough n, it's the big one that's driving it. So, certainly, if we said the constant was 3, it's obvious that 3n squared is going to always beat 3n for all positive integers, right? What if we set the constant here equal to 10 to the 10 to the 10? Is it clear that 3n squared is bigger than 10 to the 10 to the 10 times n? Well, not for small integers, but for any integer larger than 10 to the 10 to the 10, okay, this side is going to be smaller than that side, okay? Because here it's now 10 to the 10 to the 10 plus 1 squared times 10 to the 10 times 10 to the 10 plus 1. That's the break-even point. So you can't pick a big enough constant such that this side does not eventually beat that side. Okay? And that is how we prove an omega. Any questions? Okay. Upper bound, lower bound. Any questions? Theta of n is a very special bound that says tight bound. We say f of n is theta of g of n if there exists positive constants n0, a large enough integer, and two positive constants, C1 and C2, such that for all integers greater than n0, C1 times g of n is an upper bound, and C2 times g of n is a lower bound. Okay? That means that if we have f of n is theta of g of n, that means that we know that f of n is an upper bound of g of n, and f of n is a lower bound of g of n. Okay? We have a tight bound on g of n in terms of f of n. They grow basically the same thing. We know that it's both big O and big omega. That's what it means to be big theta. Any questions? Okay? So, what do we know? Is this function theta of n squared? Well, it is big O of n squared, and it is big omega of n squared. Therefore, if it's both big O, this is big O of n squared, and big theta of n squared, omega of n squared, it is theta of n squared. If this is, this one here is, if we look at this thing, it's big O, but it's not omega. Okay, this is too loose a bound on one side, n cubed to n squared. And it's too loose a bound on the other side, n squared to n. Okay? Omega. So we've got the theta is if both upper and lower bounds are tight. Otherwise, we have either an upper bound or a lower bound, hopefully. Any questions? Okay, any questions about this at all? Okay. People find... Yes, question. The tight bound means it has to be an upper... Okay, it has to be an upper and lower bound. Okay? So what would be an example of that? Okay? Suppose, let's say, that my, my money, F of N, is my stock price. And suppose that I prove that F of N really is... let's say 3 to log n. The price grows logarithmically with time. Let's say 2n plus let's say 7. This is a complicated function. If I plotted it, you know, what would it look like? I guess it's always equal to 7. It's gonna look something like this. What do I know? How can I simplify this? I claim that f of n is theta of log n. Why? Can you give me a constant such that a constant that c times log n is always bigger than f of n? Can someone give me a constant like that? What would be such a constant? Yeah? 5. Okay? For large enough values of n, is it clear that 5 log n, is it clear that 5 log n is always bigger than 2 log n plus 7? Is that clear? How would someone prove that to me? Okay? How would you prove that to me? Yeah? I subtract 2 log n from both sides. I now know that 3 log n is greater than or equal to 7. For big enough n, is that going to be true? How do you find out what that n is? Okay. Well, I'm going to punch it in a calculator and keep trying. Okay. How many other ways to do this might there be? How would I get closer to this? I would probably say it means log n equals 7 over 3, right? And now it depends upon what the base of that is, but I claim now I could compute this. Okay? But if I know what the base of that log is, that was a binary log, then, you know, I'd have to find out what is the 2 to the n. It's the k, such that 2 to the k is equal to 7/3. You know, it's an exponent type thing. We'll talk more about logs a little later. I don't want to get people too confused with logs right now. I'll do that next class. Okay. Any questions? Okay? But the important thing here is it gives me a way to think about upper and lower bounds. Okay? And to reason about, I have a complicated function. Okay? I proved the big O relationship by proving that the constant 5 times log n was good. To prove the theta, what constant times log n is always going to be less than or equal to 2 log n plus 7. What would be a good value of a constant here? What would be a good value of a constant? 0? Well, 0 would work except that we forbid 0, because 0 makes this trivial, right? If we allow not big O, but if we allow, big Q. If big Q says you're allowed 0, the Q function is not interesting. Okay? Yeah? 1, you say 1. Log 1 times log n, is 1 times log n always less than or equal to 2 log n plus 7? It's not always true, but it's always true for large enough n, right? Why do I do that? Well, subtract the log n from both sides. What does that give me? 0 here, log n plus 7. If I rearrange that, what does that give me? Minus 7. Less than or equal to log n. Okay? I find that hard to reason about. What do I do here? To get rid of the negative sign here, how do I do that? Multiply both sides by negative 1, but that reverses the sign of the inequality sign, right? Okay? I find that hard to think about, so let me try putting it on the other side. Log n. Okay? Is it true that 7 is less than... Well, okay, wait. What?
There was
a negative sign on the log n. I see. Okay, so that would reverse the signs of these things, right? Okay? Let's go back and do it more slowly. Okay? Again, it's important. The algebra is one of these things that... Once you get good enough at these things, you think about the big O stuff in your head. Okay? And I can think about these things fairly carefully. It takes a while till you're comfortable working with the notation. If you find yourself getting confused about why things are big O or not, you should stop when you've got your functions and construct those constants C and N0. That's how you prove it. So how am I going to prove that, and what was I trying to prove? I was trying to prove the omega, right? Was this the part that I was trying to prove? Is that what I was trying to prove? Okay, is there some constant